Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Thursday, August the 30th. Do democracies require art? Challenging, controversial, maybe distasteful art to ensure they are acting as free societies? Well, that's the new argument our guest makes in the book, Provoking Democracy, Why We Need the Arts. And we'll wonder if you agree with that or not, or what thoughts or questions you have for our guest about the role of the arts in politics, in our society, in democracies. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. Do you think art that you don't like maybe rap music, or maybe something you consider vulgar or indecent, something that expresses a point of view that you don't agree with, is good for democracy or not? We welcome your thoughts and questions as we go along. Our guest is Carolyn Levine, Associate Professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, specializing in relations between art and politics. Her new book is Provoking Democracy, Why We Need the Arts, and she joins us in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Yeah, thanks a lot for being here. Why do you say democracy needs the arts rather than the other way around?
Well, we're used to thinking about democracies as being free societies. We hear that from both the right and the left. But democracies are actually organized around majorities, and majorities are sometimes perfectly willing to smother voices that are on the margins, that don't fit a comfortable notion of the mainstream. So we need artists because they're like society's needlers. They keep provoking us to think outside of what we already know and are familiar with.
Yeah. So what was an example of this?
One of the examples that I think brings this home most strikingly is Maya Lin's Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C. Because when that memorial was first put up, there was huge controversy, and people said, that's not what a war memorial should look like. It should be, people holding a flag, or it should be a guy on a horse. That's how we think about memorials. And her abstract wall with these names just seemed like it didn't fit anybody's notion of what a proper memorial should look like. But now it's come to seem like one of the most moving and meaningful memorials, and in fact, much less easily forgotten than some of those guys on horses. So she provoked us to rethink what a memorial might be, and so expanded our taste, even though people didn't like it to begin with.
Yeah. Talk about, right in the beginning of the book, you talk about how the American public was polled, or maybe it was more than just the U.S., on what colors do you like, what scenes do you like in art, to find out what we liked when it came to art. Talk about that.
Yeah, there are two kind of, it's hard to say how serious they are, two artists, Russian artists, who came to the States in the early 90s. And they were really taken by the idea of opinion polls. They thought that this was a great way to gauge democracy. And they produce works of art where they poll countries around the world, and they ask people, what's your favorite color? What's your favorite style? What kinds of images do you like to see in paintings? Do you like to see famous people or dogs? And then they painted one painting that was supposed to convey the tastes of each national group. So the America's most wanted painting is in light blue. Everybody likes light blue. It's got George Washington in the middle. It's got some mountains. Their names are Komar and Melamed. And they've gone on to paint China's most wanted and Kenya's most wanted. And they're kind of parodic images, but they get to this question of whether the most democratic art is also the best art. Is it because a lot of these paintings are actually pretty funny looking.
Yeah. And the lesson is no.
No, right. That in fact, by polling a majority, what you get is a pretty flattened image of what taste is. You don't actually get a lot of richness or real thinking going on. Instead, you get this kind of yes, no. You know, is it light blue or is it red? Which is a little different from really thinking in creative ways that test the boundaries of what we already feel like we know and are familiar with.
Talk about how polling played a role in the controversy involving the play My Name is Rachel Corrie that you describe in the book.
Sure. Mm. Rachel Corrie, as many listeners will remember, was a peace activist, a U.S. peace activist, a young woman who went to Palestine to fight for Palestinian rights, and was bulldozed by an Israeli mm-hmm. tank or bulldozer. And there's a play based on her letters and diaries called My Name is Rachel Corrie, and it's just her writings. And a theater company in New York wanted to produce this play, and there were rumors that they were polling audiences, that they were asking Jewish American groups and Arab American groups, and were they asking Arab American groups? And there was a kind of scandal that grew around which populations the theater workshop was talking to. And eventually the theater company actually withdrew the play and canceled it, causing even more of a scandal. And I think that question goes to a really serious set of concerns that we should be talking about, whether we have to be ready for art to provoke us. Do we have to already have solved all the problems that art raises? Or can art provoke controversy? And are we, as a society, ready to then take up the debate? In other words, can it provoke us to start a debate? Or do we have to already have settled it and have the polls all in and have everybody agreed to some kind of consensus before we can have an art that actually gets at serious issues?
Yeah. You started off wanting to write a book just about some of the controversies when it came to arts, especially like arts and public funding or court challenges challenging art.
That's right. I was really surprised when I was doing my research. I thought I was just going to look at arts controversies and see what people had to say. I wanted to mm-hmm. see what the range of journalists and ordinary people and politicians said about the arts. And each controversy, whether it was obscenity or propaganda or copyright or public funding, everyone kept coming back to this question of art's role in a democracy. Should the majority get to say what good art is and what appropriate art is? Or should the few, should the margins, should the minority get to have a say over what art is? And so it seemed to me ultimately that democracies actually play out a lot of their debates over majority rule through the arts. And that's one of the places where we can actually think about whether majority rule is operating and how dangerous that is.
Mm-hmm. Did you find in looking over all these various controversies that, I don't know, at least our democracy is healthy or allowing this free expression?
That's a great question. I found lots of different things. I found, on the one hand, that democracies are famous for kind of promoting plural tastes and not for not imposing an official style like totalitarian regimes. But I was a little concerned to discover that democracies are capable of destroying works of art in the name of majority. So there's a case from the 1980s where Richard Serra, a sculptor who has a show on right now at the Museum of Modern Art that a lot of people are raving about, in the 1980s he was commissioned to do a work of public sculpture for downtown New York City. And it was a big abstract wall about 12 feet high. And there was huge controversy over it when it first went up, and people said, it's ugly, I don't like it. It wasn't, by the way, obscene or dangerous mm-hmm. in any way. It was just ugly, according to many people. And eventually it was removed, and according to the artist, destroyed, because he had designed it for that mm-hmm. particular place. And it was destroyed on the basis of a democratic vote. The panel that made the decision said that they had consulted the Manhattan Community Board in that local area of New York City, and that they had voted to remove the work of art. So it was, in fact, an example where democracies are capable of destroying works of art.
Yeah, interesting. If there were a vote held in Madison, we might not want that mountain of footballs outside of Camp Randall.
That's certainly what I've heard.
But we shouldn't be judging art that way.
That's a great example, because I think in that case, what a lot of people are objecting to is that it actually seems to pander to popular taste. So it seems to be about just about football. It doesn't seem to be actually asking serious questions. But I think we could do the work. What I'd always want us to be able to do as a society is to do the work of actually asking serious questions, like, why in this shape? What does this suggest? What? Why this material? Why these objects? Why so many footballs? And maybe we could have a serious discussion about
it. There's also, and I maybe that isn't the best example in the world, but that particular, besides being about football, there have been some saying, yeah, it's phallic, and that seems to be one of the ongoing themes when there's controversial art, is that some people think that it somehow is too sexual in nature and shouldn't be viewed.
Sure. So many of the major controversies about art have been over obscenity and over breaking sexual taboos. And that was one of the big surprises for me when I was doing my research, was to discover that even the debates about obscenity were really about democracy. I wasn't expecting that at all. So, for example, Lady Chatterley's Lover, the famous dirty book written in Britain in the 1920s, that came to trial in 1960. And when it was on trial, you would think that the trial would be about breaking sexual taboos and explicit representations of sex. But it turned out to be about who could read this book, because it had been kind of circulating in expensive editions that had been brought in from abroad. And people said, oh, it's okay if scholars or rich people read this book. What's dangerous is if factory workers get their hands on this book, or if teenage girls get their hands on this book. And so it ended up being a question about the democratization of culture. Who gets access to cultural objects, and who should choose who gets access? So when questions of sexuality and sexual taboos come up, it's often less about the actual content than it is about the broad mass of people and how it is that they're engaging with culture.
We're talking with Carolyn Levine. She is the author of Provoking Democracy, Why We Need the Arts. Especially challenging art, or art that we may not like or understand. We need the art to ensure we're acting as a free society. 1-800-642-1234. We welcome your thoughts, your questions, your observations, your example of a controversy involving the arts. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hoping you'll stay tuned. John Munson in for Ben Marins this afternoon between 4 and 6, talking about current issues of the day. Tomorrow at this time, it's our Friday Week in Review. We'll have two guests from different perspectives to talk with you about the news of the week every Friday in our 8 o'clock hour. Right now, we're talking with Carolyn Levine, who is author of Provoking Democracy, Why We Need the Arts. And let's go to the phones and take our first caller, Leah in Green Bay. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Well, I'd like to turn the question around and ask Professor Levine, if there were a really ugly piece of art that you looked at it and you hated, and someone said you had to have it in your living room, would you like that? I mean, I'm an artist. I like the idea of public art, but if the community, for aesthetic reasons, didn't like Richard Serra's wall, why should they be forced to have it there?
That's a great question, Leah. I think that a couple of ways I'd want to answer you on that. One was that the question of who speaks for the community is a really problematic one. At least that was what I learned when I was reading about the Richard Serra case, that this small community board who had taken a vote was not necessarily representative of all the people who would walk through that plaza where the sculpture was. That would include foreign visitors. It would include future generations. And often, as you as an artist know, art is not necessarily appreciated in the first moment when it appears. And it only was given a couple of years, five, I think, before it was actually taken down. So so part of the question is, who represents the community to us? And the other part of the question for me is, when it comes to my own living room, I get to act like a consumer. I get to choose, do I want this in my living room or not? I get to put my dollars where I want them. And the marketplace is really good at giving us what we already like. But do we need some arena? And I think we do. You might disagree, Leah, but do we need some arena where we look at things that we don't necessarily feel comfortable with? I myself, to answer your first question, came across a lot of works of art in this project that I did not like, but I grew to respect and appreciate them after kind of doing the work of listening to all the arguments on the different sides. And that was part of what persuaded me that we should fund art that we don't like, that people are often persuaded by the arguments, even when their first reaction is, I hate it.
Well, could I tell you a funny story?
Sure.
Well, I do some collaborative work with another artist, and one of our pieces was up in a gallery, and the gallery owner came to me and said, I don't think you should hang this. We should hang this here because some people say they're disturbed by it. So I really didn't want to argue with her because she's a very nice person and I have other art there. And I called up my collaborator and I said, I think we're onto something. We must be doing art because people are disturbed by it.
That's
so
what makes it
we're going to go to New York and do it.
Well, keep on disturbing people, all right,
yeah, right.
Leah?
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call. What about that? Art that disturbs us, that's art.
I think there's something to it. I think art that doesn't disturb us may not really be doing its job. That is, if it just gives us what we already like and what we're already comfortable with, it's just reaffirming things that are already out there in our culture. And art does its best work, I think, when it's on the boundaries, on the frontiers, and really asking serious questions. Later, we might come to appreciate it. I always think of the Impressionists, because now they seem so beautiful and so kind of tame to us mm-hmm. compared to other works of art. But and we wouldn't want them to be banned from museums, but they were a huge focus of scandal when they were first shown in the late 19th century. So I think it may be a question of expanding our taste kind of gradually and slowly.
Well, that's interesting, too, because when Leah first brought it up, it was public funding of some public art thing that you drive by and it's downtown and it's not, you don't have to go walking into the museum to see it. Right. So there are two different things there, too, that there's, you know, somebody says, hey, I have no choice but to drive by this, but you do have a choice to walk in the museum, yet there's a lot of controversy over that kind of art as well, that public funding should not go into Robert Mapplethorpe, for mm-hmm. example. Wasn't that...
That was definitely inside a museum and not on the public mm-hmm. street. Yeah, that raises some, I think, really important questions about access and about who is the audience for art. So on the one hand, you say, okay, you could fund disturbing works of art as long as it's inside the walls of a museum and only mm-hmm. people who choose to go, go. But on the other hand, what if the people who choose to go tend to be the better off, the better educated, people who don't really need subsidy for works of art? Then aren't you just confining it once again to a kind of private space where only elites tend to go? So public art, I think, gets at that question. What if we're all capable of being challenged, even those of us who wouldn't bother to go inside a museum? We might still find ourselves transformed in some way by public works of art.
Yeah. And some of it's not public funded at all, wasn't it? I mean, the rat suckling on Madonna, I mean, I don't think that was a public arts work, was it?
Gosh, I don't know one.
Okay. Well, I mean, just a private artist doesn't have to have government funding to put together a controversial work.
Sure, yeah. That's certainly true. And there have been a lot of cases like Ice-T, the rapper. He severed his relationship with, I think it was Warner Records, because he felt like they were the target of controversy and he wanted to be more independent. And so he put out his own independent label after he produced the song Cop Killer, which was a huge, huge scandal.
Talk about Two Live Crew. You follow their case in the book.
Yeah, that was back from the early 90s. Two Live Crew was a rap group that offended everybody. It seemed like they had these images of sex and explicit images of sex that bothered conservatives. They had lots of representations of violence against women, which bothered liberals. And so it just seemed as though everybody was up in arms over mm-hmm. Two Live Crew, and they were hauled into court and accused of obscenity. And one of the surprises for me in that case was that Two Life Crew actually won their case in court. So it would seem as though they weren't pleasing anybody. They were not on mm-hmm. anybody's side. But the law has actually been pretty friendly to radical in the sense of sort of unsettling artists in the last century. And they let Two Life Crew go. They didn't accuse them of obscenity on the grounds that it was art and it had innovated. It had pushed the boundaries of what was recognizable rap convention by combining a kind of Miami beat with what had been a Bronx sound and by using these kind of parodic sexual images that were supposed to be making fun of mainstream ideas about sex and sexuality. So although it seemed like at the time the case was all about race and sex, the courtroom actually confirmed Two Live Crew's contribution to society on the grounds that it was artistically innovative and challenging.
And that's where I think a lot of people might still be scratching their heads. How can these lyrics and images of sex and violence, how is that contributing to society?
Well, maybe a better example would actually be Cop Killer, although Two Life Crew, I think, fits this too. But Cop Killer seemed so inflammatory because, I mean, really, and you could see why it would upset people. But Ice-T was very clear that the first person lyric in his song was not himself. He wasn't speaking autobiographically. And anybody who studies art and literature learns that there are certain techniques of representing voices that aren't necessarily just about the truth of personal experience. And so to say something is art or it isn't art is partly to ask new questions about it, not just is there somebody out there who wants to kill cops, but how can art represent that feeling or that desire? And is it important for us to recognize that there are people in this society who feel that angry and that marginalized and alienated, that that's their desire? In other words, can we face the fact that that happens to be a part of our society? Or do we have to squelch it because we're afraid of even mentioning it?
Our guest is Carolyn Levine. She is author of Provoking Democracy, Why We Need the Arts, talking about democracies need challenging or controversial or maybe even to some distasteful art to push the boundaries to ensure we are acting as free societies. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We welcome your thoughts, your questions for her, whether you agree or not with that argument that democracies need the arts. Brian in Dubuque. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Good.
You know, I've discovered is that art is great. It's all financially motivated as far as if it affects us financially. It's like I can create something that I love, but if it offends somebody, and I make a living at it as well, then I have to, in essence, I have to backtrack and say, okay, now I have to do something that I can make a living at. So I have to create two separate pieces of art. I have to create what I like, and then I have to create what I can sell. And the same thing is kind of what's going on with you folks right now with your funding is you can say, well, our art form is public radio and we do a great job at it. But if somebody came to you and said, well, I'll tell you what, you guys are having some trouble financially. We'll give you $10 million if you put Howard Stern on your radio station. See, secondly,
oh,
all
there's
the
an idea.
There you go now, see? But see, you know, what I'm talking about is sometimes you have to kind of create two pieces of art. You have to do what you like, and then you have to do what's going to make a living. Does that make sense?
Oh, definitely. And I think that's kind of a tragedy, actually. Other societies put a lot more funding into the arts than U.S. society, and I think artists in our society do have to make a living by pleasing public galleries, whatever the venue might be. Whereas France and Germany have, just to name a couple of examples, have a much stronger tradition of supporting artists who are at the cutting edge and doing disturbing and surprising things. We have, at a couple of moments in our history, done better at providing funds for artists. I was just reading the other day about the Works Progress Administration under the New Deal, and their artists were actually paid by the hour, some of them, to produce canvases. It was just a work program, just trying to keep artists from starving. And they were allowed to do, at least for a brief period, absolutely whatever they wanted. So they were paid by the hour. They had to clock in and clock out. But they could, the content of it was really varied. And some of the really great U.S. artists of the 40s and 50s got their start during the WPA.
Yeah, it's interesting, Brian, and I'm not going to turn this to public broadcasting funding, but there are some critics of taxpayer support of public broadcasting because some think that, the liberal ideas that they hear, that taxpayers shouldn't be paying for it. Is that sort of is there a similarity there in your argument?
Definitely, definitely. I think of the whole realm of free expression as being connected, sure. I think art is unusual in it's an institution that since the late 19th century has actually been defined by its defiance of the mainstream. Public radio tries, and I think succeeds at trying to be really even-handed and representing multiple points of view. Artists, on the other hand, say, nuts to the majority. We're just going to do what we want. Or at least they have a tradition of doing that. And I think that that's it's a kind of different institutional social role, but both are crucial, absolutely crucial to the question of public discourse.
Dan in La Crosse is with us now. Hi, Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, I really enjoy the program. I'm a songwriter, and I try to lampoon both sides of the ideological aisle. I do suggest that all art, including music, should have some basic principles, accountability, integrity as opposed to hypocrisy, and critical thinking. So it's fair game to lampoon the lampooners. And promoting irresponsibility in the name of art isn't cool, in my humble opinion. And talking about varied art, as in the WPA, the principles of variation and selection. I'm a theistic evolutionist, and I do believe in freedom to create, just brainstorm, but then you have to pick the best, the most honest out of what you come up with.
Do you think, Dan, that there's any role for deliberate explorations of dishonesty or irresponsibility?
Oh, sure. Lampoon the lampooners and critique the critiquers.
Uh-huh.
As long as you're willing to stick around and take it. if you dish it out, I think you should be willing to take it.
It's really interesting to think about those particular values, responsibility, integrity, not being hypocritical. I think a lot of artists would stand by those values, and critical thinking was another one that Dan mentioned. I myself am a tiny bit wary about saying these are the values, because I think that's exactly where the question of standardization starts to come in. But I'm interested in those particular ones. Those seem like they'd be, a lot of artists would say, yes, that's what I do stand for.
Could I give one example of a parody I wrote?
Sure, why not?
Okay. There's a great song called Can't Help Loving That Man of Mine. And I work with, I'm a teacher, and I work with mental health and substance abusing young people. So my song is called Won't Stop Respecting That Self of Mine. And I believe in freedom, but in thinking long term, and what will be the results of the way I use my freedom?
Mm-hmm. And the long term is often surprising, I think, because tastes change pretty radically from generation to generation. And so some of the artistic acts that people thought of as really shocking in one moment turn out to be standard or valuable in another moment. And so I think it's interesting to think about what that responsibility is for the artist. Who is your audience? What groups are you speaking for now or in the future? Can you imagine what it will be like 20 or 50 or 100 years hence? And how is your work going to speak to another moment? And I think, rather than just saying that art is lasts forever or it's for everyone at all times, I think it's interesting to think about how you might be ushering in a new set of tastes by producing parody that asks questions about how we think about our relationship to ourselves right now.
Yeah, thanks very much, Dan, for the call. We're talking about the power of art and how it has challenged political boundaries throughout history. And our guest is saying we need this challenge. This challenging art, provocative art, is needed to encourage the growth of a healthy democracy. She says that democracies need the arts. And we're wondering what you think about that, what questions you have. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Carolyn Levine is Associate Professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her new book is Provoking Democracy, Why We Need the Arts. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up, Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock, talking with her guest about whether the U.S. is facing a nationwide teacher shortage and how baby boomer retirement and high turnover rates are affecting the education workforce. That's after 9 o'clock this afternoon. This morning. We're talking about the arts and how democracies need the arts with Carolyn Levine, an associate professor of English at UW-Madison. You tell the story of Jackson Pollock in the book, and tell us, Professor Levine, how his art and his story fits into your thesis.
Sure. I think one of the biggest challenges for democracies around the question of freedom is during wartime, because they're typically trying to repress lots of individual freedoms in the name of collective security. We know a lot about this recently. And in the 1940s and 50s, during the Cold War, U.S. strategists were getting really frustrated because the Soviets seemed to be winning the propaganda war, especially with non-aligned countries. They were accusing the U.S. of being a shallow materialist culture that, you know, was just all about money and Hollywood and didn't have a real, a genuine culture. And so the CIA launched this sneaky plan to promote radical American art. They had to do so secretly because this was the moment of McCarthyism, and the Congress was certainly not at all interested in promoting radical art. They were busy trying to blacklist anybody in Hollywood who was even the slightest bit subversive. So they pretty much launched Jackson Pollock to fame. They even got him a big spread in Life magazine. And it was quite remarkably successful around the world. Audiences, especially elites who were kind of opinion makers in countries where they were trying to decide between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, said, wow, this American art is amazing. It's brave. It breaks new ground. It's radical. And so the U.S. could point to abstract expressionism and say, you know, look at Jackson Pollock. We must be a free society if we promote, you know, if our most famous artist is someone like Jack the Dripper, we must really be a brave and free society. And I, you know, I don't want to say that I'm on the side of covert art right. operations, but I do think that there's something in that choice that's really worth thinking about. That is, we don't have to do it secretly. We can say to ourselves, if we want to be a free society, how do we demonstrate that to ourselves? Do we do it by promoting surprising, weird, outlandish expression that doesn't fit any kind of set program about what culture should be and should look like?
Yeah, and at the time too, Pollock's artwork was not really loved here.
No,
I mean, nobody liked it here, and yet it was being sent overseas or whatever.
Absolutely. And, yeah. He was mocked in the press. And
Jack the Dripper.
Jack the Dripper, right. Yeah. And he was actually accused of being a subversive and a communist. And to some extent, he was. He had leftist leanings in the 30s and 40s, which he sort of given up by the time he was really famous. But you know, it was easy for someone like McCarthy to say, no, this is subversive American art. And there were a lot of people in Congress saying modern art is communist. And it's, you know, it's all about serving the ends of the Soviets. So now Jackson Pollock might not look so subversive, but at the moment mm-hmm. he was.
Terry in Mercer is with us now. Hi, Terry.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was going to share a story about a project I've been working on for about 3 years. I started traveling around the Northwoods looking for an educational organization that would like to sponsor an art exhibit on climate change. And at the time, 3 years ago, it was almost everywhere I went, they'd kind of give me this sideways look like, are you kidding? This is too political. And funders were sort of hesitant, and people really didn't want to get involved. And luckily, about 2 years ago, I ran into some folks from UW-Madison, and we got a grant and put this together. But the interesting part is that now, in just that short time period, public opinion has shifted to the extent that it's not even seen as controversial in the same way that it was only 3 years ago. And I think it's interesting to think about that in the context of how our society, how quickly we change in our opinions. So now, as it's traveling, we're getting all sorts of positive responses. In some ways, I almost wish it was a little more negative.
Yeah, no one's protesting it.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, Terry, whether you're disappointed to be part of the mainstream.
Well, kind of. And, you know, in some ways, it was sort of this perfect thing where the exhibit came out right after Al Gore's movie made kind of a big splash. So I think in the long run, lots of people are going because it's more acceptable, but it's not quite as controversial as I'd maybe hoped.
Yeah, interesting example, isn't it?
It's a beautiful example. And it goes to a whole bunch, as Terry said, it goes to a whole bunch of these questions like, you know, how fast public opinion changes. So we like to think of our views as being really authentic and coming from ourselves. But actually, if we're swayed by the ways in which media representations work, and I think we are swayed, and I include myself in that, you know, an idea of the mainstream is really this kind of shifting, the idea of community values and community tastes. It's really, you know, you couldn't pin it down. And so in 3 short years, you've got a total shift in public opinion.
Thank you, Terry, very much for the call and the example. More callers. Peter in Milwaukee. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking our call. I am a poet and have been writing poetry for probably 30 years. But my perspective on the arts is that freedom in the arts requires responsibility and that there's a need to cultivate awareness. And good literature, good poetry, and good art seems to tender insight into the human situation.
Mm-hmm. But who decides what's good then, Peter?
Well, I didn't say good. I just said it demands responsibility and that good art tenders insight. Now, if it tenders insight, then it seems to be good art.
I see. All right.
I'm wondering whether... another way to ask your question, Peter, is to say, to restate your point, is to say that, you know, once we've given artists the benefit of the doubt for, if we assume that artists are trying to tender insight and are trying to be responsible, we actually have a different view of what art objects are. So I'm thinking of really, really famous artwork because of its scandalous nature in the late 1980s, Andre Serrano's image was a photograph of a crucifix dipped in urine that people were just outraged by. And she might say, oh, that's irresponsible. He's just mocking religion. But I think there was a strong argument that he himself made. He's a practicing Catholic, that he was exploring the question of what it means for a god to be made human into flesh. Doesn't that mean also thinking about bodily fluids? And, you know, if we can't think about bodily fluids, then what does it mean for a god to be made flesh? And so, you know, I wonder whether sometimes what happens is a kind of misunderstanding about how much integrity and responsibility an artist is actually taking. In other words, can an artist provoke us in a serious way? And do we sometimes not take them up on their provocations? Do we sometimes say, oh, that's just self-indulgent, I don't want to bother with that? And are we missing something when we do that?
Mm-hmm.
I think we sometimes do miss that. So what art does is actually foster a kind of a thoughtfulness on our part if we want art.
Right.
And most people do in one form or another. To paraphrase your crucifixion with urine, in a lower level in a sense, Donovan back in the 70s used to sing about the astronauts, even the greatest astronauts have to shit and pee. You know, it's the...
I think I was supposed to delete that off the air. I don't think I think it... well, it's in the context of controversial
art,
so I think that... I hope that no one's going to complain to the FCC, which is yet another example of what you're saying. Deacon in Plymouth, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, how are you?
Good, great.
Just
to hear from
wanted
you.
To relate a small story to you. I belong to a performing arts group in the just north of Milwaukee in a town called Plymouth. And a couple of years ago, as our fall play, we decided to put on the Laramie Project, which at the time was a big play. And the four-person executive board of the Arts Foundation we belong to decided that the community was not ready for it and did not want to have the play. And therefore, they removed us from the Arts Foundation. So we went on, we put the play on anyway at a local church, and we had sellout audiences. Obviously, the community was ready for it, and they accepted it very well. But here we were censored and put in place by a four-person board who thought that they viewed... They had the view of the community at heart, and it turns out that it was pretty much their view, which was a four person board was able to effectively stomp on a theatrical.
Wow, that's a really fascinating example of something that I came to really believe over the course of doing my research, which is that artists are often accused of being elitists because they produce this difficult, challenging work that people say communities aren't ready for. But it's often the people who are making the decision to censor the artworks who are the real elitists, the ones who are saying, no, you can't, you as a community can't see this, you're not ready for it. That's basically saying to us we're too immature to be able to take on the serious issues. And so it really, I would much rather call, it's kind of an ugly word, but I'd much rather call artists alternativists than elitists, just to get us to think, to think about them as just being unfamiliar rather than they themselves are trying to impose an elite view on the rest of us.
Deacon, thank you for the call. Robert in Barrington, hi, you're on the air.
I wanted to ask Carolyn Levine if she thinks that there's any limit to what should be allowed in the arts. More specifically, is there a point at which artistic expression incites violence and breaks the law?
Yes, there is. What's surprising to me is how often arts controversies aren't about those moments. So incitements to violence are against the law. I certainly, myself, don't want to see any actual people getting hurt by art objects, and some artists have proposed that. But so often, arts controversies are actually just about style. They're not about even offenses to religion or sexuality. They're just about strange and unsettling ways of seeing the world. And so I think sometimes we say too much about the art that we think of as potentially dangerous, and not enough about how valuable the challenges that are, within the realm of the imagination. So there's nobody who's actually being hurt by them could be.
Do you believe that policemen are people too?
Oh, sure. And Cop Killer, I think, is a really, really great example of this because it so gets to the heart of the question of incitement to violence and does a representation of a voice of somebody who is angry at the police, angry enough to do violence. Is that the same as actually inciting violence in a population? And I think we need to have a really serious public conversation about that. So I think that's a really valuable question. But I myself am not afraid of having lots of ideas out there, as long as there really are lots of them, as long as one or two ideas don't dominate the whole political scene and squelch alternatives.
I wonder if that controversy we saw about a year ago, when there were riots in the Muslim world over the cartoons portraying the Prophet Muhammad and how how that incited just those cartoons incited violence, and then there was a big controversy whether or not this was fair game or not. Do you have any? I mean, how does that play into the theme in your book?
I guess it's a question about whether a cartoonist is actually responsible for producing that violence or not. And I think, it's a tough question, but Salman Rushdie, also there's another fatwa issued just recently over him yet again when he was knighted in Britain, and riots in Pakistan over Salman Rushdie. So is Rushdie responsible for that violence, or is he becoming a focus of such intense debate that's otherwise violent that it's provoked or not? I think that is a question that we need to think about the sources of violence. And I myself would say that the art object is not, in fact, the source of the violence. The violence comes from other other roots.
Yeah. We're almost out of time, and I don't know if we got to the story about the Jewish artist who challenged the fascist majority.
Oh, yeah. So that's one of the more disturbing cases that I looked into. A Jewish-American artist named Jacob Epstein was commissioned in the 1920s to do a public sculpture for London's Hyde Park, so a really symbolic national space. And he produced a sculpture that was not obscene or violent in any way, not offensive in any particular way. It was just strange. The style was strange. And it provoked immediate and intense outcry, lots of people calling for its removal. And they kept saying, commentators kept saying, it's not English enough. It's not English. And eventually, fascist groups started scrawling epithets on the sculpture in green paint about the Jewishness of the artist. And so what the lesson of that controversy, it seems to me, is that majority rule in a democracy does actually have something in common potentially with fascism. That is, the fear that marginal minority voices are so disruptive or unsettling that they have to be literally erased. And so that was a case that made me start to really think about majority rule and what its genuine dangers are. And the Epstein sculpture is actually still standing, and it's now almost completely unknown. It doesn't bother anybody anymore. So it's an example where it kind of faded into history.
One last call from Valerie in Boaz. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I tuned into your program right to hear you mentioning my painting, Madonna and Rat. I had two quick points about my experience with that. One was that people were disturbed by the title of the piece without ever seeing the actual work, and it just became a concept that bothered people. And the other was, and regarding integrity and having to take that into account, the artist's intentions, I was basically vilified, called a liar when I explained my reasons for doing the piece. It just wasn't accepted.
I'm very surprised that you called in. You're saying that this was your piece of art.
Correct.
That's so great.
Yeah, that's what it was. It was called Madonna and Rat. And then did it get taken down? And
it did. It got removed from a high school art gallery, and then it got into USA Today, and it went national, but not with an image included.
Right.
And so it was just criticized all over the place without anyone knowing what the painting looked like.
That is such that's so fascinating, and it's such a classic case of what happens where people vilify artworks without actually looking at them or listening to them and deciding on the basis of their titles or their subject matter. Rudy Giuliani, when he was running for Senate in 1999, 2000, was vilifying this sensation show in the Brooklyn Museum, and he had never seen it. So it's another example, and I think I'm so glad that you called in.
Well, I am too, and I'm sorry we're out of time, and we can't talk more. Valerie, thanks very much, and Carolyn Levine, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Joy.
Yeah, Carolyn Levine, author of Provoking Democracy, Why We Need the Arts. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.